Okay, so I'm going to be giving the next talk in our series on Dharma in the City, which is a very catchy title, isn't it, Dharma in the City, but I was thinking, well, what exactly does that mean? Because actually, what is different about Dharma practice in the city to Dharma practice elsewhere? The teachings are the same, the practice is the same. We're working to transform the same root poisons. We're trying to gain the same kinds of insights. So in a way, wherever we are should be immaterial. But I did think, well, actually, there are certain external conditions that are different when you're living in a city. So what are they, and why is that relevant, and how can we make use of it, really, in a way? Because I think sometimes we can sort of think that living in a city is not helpful to our practice. You know, that the best thing to do is to go on retreats as much as we can, get away from the city, have sort of nice, calm, peaceful, spacious time in the countryside, or maybe to go on solitaries, even go and spend some time living in a bit more reclusive life. And I think those can all be very, very beneficial, but I think it can also be very beneficial living in the city. There's different sides of ourselves, different things that we can work with living in a city to we do when we're on retreat. So I think what I'd like to explore in a way is that duality, and in a way bring out more the opportunities that we have living in a city. So this talk's kind of going to have three main areas. One of it's going to be looking at ways of cultivating metta, partly through meditation and the metta bhavana practice, and partly through practicing ethics. And it's going to be linked in a way to one of the Buddha's key teachings or formulations of the spiritual path, which is the threefold path of ethics, meditation, and wisdom. And then also trying to look at some of the challenges and opportunities for spiritual practice living in an urban environment. So why did I want to talk about the threefold path? Well, it kind of felt quite natural because I'm wanting to look in a way about the inner life, the outer life, what we're doing with our mental states, what we're doing with our practice in the world, and the key ways that we work with those are with meditation and with ethics. But also, why are we doing it? What's the context for that? What's the context for our practice? And that's the teachings of the Buddha, the wisdom of the Buddha. And in particular, when I'm looking at, you know, practicing in the city and looking at conditions, it's felt like it would make sense to look at conditionality, one of the key insights that the Buddha had at the time of his enlightenment. So I'm just going to say a bit about conditionality, which a lot of you probably will already know, but I just thought it's a place that you can revisit. And it's such a core teaching for me. It's, in a way, quite one of the foundations of my practice, so I just thought I'd say some stuff about that. One of the things that the Buddha saw during his enlightenment was that everything was in process, a constant process of change. Nothing was fixed, nothing was permanent. That insight of impermanence. And that was from big things to little things, everything was changing. And that this process of change wasn't random. That things came into being, things ended, things changed, independence on conditions, upon different sets of conditions. So that's where we get this teaching that's often called conditioned co-production, or sometimes the law of conditionality. And it's an aspect of reality, the way things really are, that this is happening, that the world is conditioned, that everything is changing upon sets of conditions. And it can be applied to any context, really. So whether it's the formation of a universe, whether it's a volcano erupting, whether it's the weather, whether it's our mental states, whether it's what's happening in the world, in politics, and all that kind of stuff, that's all arising independence on sets of conditions. We grow old, we die, that's all independence on conditions. People are born, plants grow, all those things are arising dependent on sets of conditions. So you can apply this law almost universally. Yeah. And there's a sort of famous formulation of it in the Buddha's teaching, which I really like, which is, this being, that becomes. On the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. On the ceasing of this, that ceases. So it's very simple, but actually, the more you reflect on it, the more you kind of apply it to different situations, the more you realise quite how profound, quite how helpful that teaching is. I know for myself, when I started to see how conditionality was operating in my life, and how it was operating in my mind, that really gave me a way in for my practice, in a different kind of way. Because I think it does mean that if you take it on board, then you realise you can make use of that law. You know, if things depend, arise in dependent conditions, well, if you change conditions, you know, something else can arise or something can cease. You know, if you're in really shitty conditions, you know, you can change them. You know, you may not be able to change all the external conditions, but you can change some of how you respond to them, which is another key thing in our practice. But you may be able to actually change something in the external conditions that will make a shift. And you could actually see spiritual practice in terms of trying to create positive conditions for yourself and for others. And that we're working on that on two fronts. We're working on creating more positive conditions in our mental states and also more positive conditions in the world outside. And from a Buddhist point of view, thoughts are actions. And all our actions have consequences. Yeah. So ethical actions, skillful actions will have beneficial consequences for ourselves and others. We may not immediately experience it, but we can. That follows according to this. And then also, if we act unethically or unskillfully, that's going to have harmful consequences for ourselves and others. Again, we may not notice it straight away, but it will. But actually, I think there's an immediate way that we often experience this in terms of our mental states. You know, if we're mean to somebody, if we're cruel to somebody, we don't feel good. It does affect how we feel, our mental state. We get into much more negative mental states. You know, if we're kind, considerate to someone, if we have a really nice interaction with someone, that will make us feel more positive. So there's a kind of feedback loop in terms of our actions in the world and our mental states. So all of them are conditioned. You know, how we are in every given moment, our physical states, our emotional states, our mental states, those are all conditioned. Partly by things that have happened in the past, partly by what's happening around us now. Yeah. And they are in themselves conditioning factors on how we act in the world. So depending on what kind of state we're in, depending what our physical state is, our emotional state, our mental state is, that will affect how we act in the world. So, you know, in meditating, one of the things we're doing is trying to bring more and more awareness to those states and give a bit of space around our reactions so we can maybe respond more creatively rather than out of habit, out of our conditioning, which is often unconscious. Yeah. Often stuff that happened to us when we were very young, we were then in a situation when we were an adult, we just respond in a way without thinking about it, probably quite inappropriately or quite, you know, with a lot more energy than it should really have, you know, because of that conditioning that we're, you know. So we're working in our practice to sort of see through, become aware of that, see through that conditioning, see through our false views, let go of some of those habits so that we can act more skillfully. And the more skillfully we act, the better mental states will be. And so they do kind of like reinforce each other, can get into a sort of spiral if you actually choose to work the conditions. You know. So wisdom the wisdom of something like conditionality, being aware of impermanence and things like that, that can provide the context for our practice. And that can sort of give us a sense of purpose for why we're doing it. And our practice can also lead to more insights, you know. So again, they're all kind of interlinked, these three themes of meditation, wisdom and ethics. So that's just the kind of background for what I wanted to talk about, conditionality. So now I'd like to sort of talk a little bit more about metta and developing metta. So metta in terms of kindness and a kindness, love, compassion, sense of care, concern for the well-being of other living beings. Well, for all living beings, including ourselves, actually, not just other living beings, but equally for ourselves. And how we do that. Yeah, so if we're working with our mental states, then we're going to be working with that primarily through meditation. And the Metta-Bhavana practice is a practice which is specifically designed to help us work with that. And to work with feelings of aversion, ill will, animosity, hatred in particular. But also to help us to kind of develop, access, cultivate our capacity for kindness and compassion. And I think it's helpful to use that analogy of cultivation, that we all have the seeds of kindness and compassion within us, even if they're not expressed or they're not very strong at a particular time. We have that potential, and if we create the right conditions, just like if you have a seed that can be in its hard shell for many, many years, you give it the right conditions and it will grow. And depending on how well you look after it, and if it's got enough light, warmth, sun, water, and it's the right particular conditions for that particular plant, then it will thrive. Yeah. So in a way, we're all individuals, we're all different kinds of people, like different kinds of plants, so we need different sorts of conditions. But if we create the right conditions, then we can develop our potential, and we can develop all the dharmic spiritual qualities we have, which include kindness and metta. And it's not as if metta is something that we're having to fabricate or make or manufacture. It just is there. It's there in the world, it's there within us. So it's more being receptive to it, to recognizing it, and to owning it and kind of, you know, freeing it in a way. So the Metta-Bhavana practice, I think, is quite good for that, because we're doing two things in a way. We're trying to get in touch with those feelings, those emotions, that energy, but we're also, in a way, doing the weeding, you know, the things that get in the way, the conditions, the views, our habits that stop us from doing that. Yeah. So, I don't know about you, but certainly for me, it's taken me a long time to actually feel okay about myself as a human being. You know, I had very low self-esteem, a lot of self-hatred, a lot of internalised, very, very critical voices, you know. One of them, you know, even that I didn't deserve to live, but lots of ones about, oh, you know, for me, giving a talk like this is quite a, well, it's still quite a challenge, but there was a time when even just to say a word in public would have been terrifying, you know. So that's part of my conditioning that I'm working with. I think everybody has their own conditionings, but there's partly behind that was the thought that I've got nothing worth to say, or I shouldn't put myself forward, or all those kinds of other things. Yeah. So with the Metta-Bhavana, when we're sitting there, when we bring yourself to mind, we may not actually feel self-metta. What may happen is all those kinds of critical voices and things pop up, but becoming more aware of them, in a way, seeing what you're working with is part of that process. And you get more and more familiar, and here it goes again, here it goes again. And you, in a way, you sort of see that it's just thoughts, you know. And it may not be true, you know. It may be just something that you've got into the habit of believing and acting according to that belief. But it's not true. So doing this practice, I think, can be quite an inside practice of seeing through false views and letting go of some of that conditioning at the same time as working with our emotions. So I would say that don't worry if you do this practice and you find yourself not feeling metta, but feeling the opposite, you know, whether it's towards yourself or towards someone else, because that's part of the process. What is important is intention, and a kind of volition, and we're working with our attitudes and our intentions just as much as we're working with emotional states. Yeah. It's not all about just feeling lots of love all the time. Sometimes you do this practice and you're not feeling anything, or you're feeling hatred or whatever, but that can still be very, very fruitful. And if you take the long view, you will actually experience the benefits of that. So, in what way does it help us in our relations to other people? Well, it's quite interesting that all our experience of the world, in a way, is mediated through the mind and the body. You know, we get our experience of the world through the senses, you know, whether we're seeing, smelling, touching, whatever it is. That's how we do it. We see the world, and then we kind of filter it through our mind, and we interpret it through our mind, and we kind of have an internalized view of the world, and an internalized view of all the people that we encounter or have encountered in the past, and that's our reality, in a way. And then we react according to that reality in the world. So this worldview does influence how we behave, but it may not actually be accurate. Yeah, and particularly when we think about the internalized views we have of other people. You know, it may be that we've got an idea about someone based on an interaction we had with them 20 years ago. You know, families, it's very, very easy to just sort of see people as they are and not actually let them grow and be individuals. You just sort of want them to be how they are. You know, even with friends and things, sometimes we do that. And we're not always aware of how much our conditionings are affecting those views of people, or how limited they may be, or how it may just have been, you know, somebody was a bit short with us and we didn't like it, and therefore we think, oh, we want to avoid that person, or I don't like that person, and then it's so easy to get into that's not a nice person, you know. And then years later we meet them again and we have this view they're not a nice person, when it may just have been they'd had a really difficult day and they were, you know, they took it out on us kind of without thinking, you know, but that's just what we think of that person. We fix them in that kind of a way. So when we're practicing the metta, we're trying to have a bit more awareness of people, the whole complexity of the person, not just see them in terms of how they relate to us or what we've seen about them. And we're also working with our responses to them, being aware of how we react and trying to be real, not trying to pretend that we don't actually feel jealousy or envy or annoyance towards somebody if that's what we feel, but also being aware that those are just feelings, those are just emotions, you know, and again, we don't necessarily have to take them as true or real, though in process all our emotions, all our thoughts are changing all the time, just as everything else is. So when we feel ourselves having that kind of response, you know, the meditation, if we're aware of it, gives us that choice, that space, are we going to react from that? Yeah. Are we going to choose to act from our better impulses or from our more petty or more self-concerned impulses? I think that's kind of the choice we get when we have more awareness, and that's where we get into the area of ethics, you know, where we're choosing to try and behave in a way according to our potential, our better impulses, according to values like love and kindness, about being generous, all these kinds of things. Yeah. Whether or not we may actually feel that, or whether or not we have mixed feelings, we can still choose to act as if we were, you know, and it will have an effect, it will have a beneficial effect on our mental states, because there is that loop where when we act kindly or generously, we actually will end up feeling a bit better in our minds. And it will have an effect on other people if we are more open, more friendly, more generous. So I think we don't always realise the effect that we have on other people, actually. We can't really, we don't know. Sometimes I'm completely surprised, you know, that somebody that I don't even remember or that I had an encounter with many, many years ago will come to me and say, oh, it was really significant in some way. When I was here quite quite soon after I started here, I did this course, this afternoon course. I think you run it, Kathy, the one on
the Buddhas.
The Buddhas, yes. And there's this woman who'd come from the East London Buddhist Centre, and I thought, oh, she must, because I used to be based there, and I thought, oh, well, she must have come to some things that I've learned, like my teaching and something like that. But actually, the reason she came was I'd been friendly to her in a tea break, you know, and it had quite an impact on her. I used to support some of the parent-children retreats, and I was sort of like looking after the kids. And I was at a party last year, and there was this grown-up young man, and he was looking at me and looking at me, and at a point he came up to me and he asked me if I'd used to do those retreats, and I said yes, and he said, oh, do you remember me? And I did. When he said his name, I did. You know, and he said he just wanted to come and thank me because I was the first person that had actually listened to him and taken him seriously when he was, you know, 12 or whatever it was. And, you know, for me, I wasn't aware of that. I was just aware that this was a child who was going through a difficult time. You know, and, you know, it was having an effect on me, and I was sort of trying not to worry about it, but just tried to be there as best I could. And I certainly didn't think I'd been that helpful to him. So, you know, we don't know what effect we have. Just smiling at somebody can make their day. You know, certainly I know when somebody's kind to me and smiles to me in the street, it makes me feel happier. So I think don't dismiss sort of random acts and little simple acts of kindness. I'm just going all off topic, but anyway, never mind. Yeah, so when we're working with our minds, yeah, we're just trying to cultivate an attitude of being for the welfare of others, being for others, kind of sense of solidarity with other living beings. We can't control our minds, we can't control our thoughts or our emotions, so when we're doing this practice, you know, if you're trying to do that, you're on a losing wicket, I'm afraid. But what we can do is try and create different attitude, different habits, you know, and learn to be more aware of what we are, what we have. And maybe quite often we're more focused on our more negative sides or the things that we lack. So I think doing this practice, particularly in the first stage of self-metta, to begin to actually appreciate one's own qualities and one's own spiritual qualities and value oneself and be for yourself, I think that is really, really important. And in a way, that's the foundation of metta, because if you can't do that for yourself, how can you really genuinely do that for somebody else? So in a way, we're just trying to train ourselves to be more receptive, kinder, less judgmental, and yeah, more positive in a way. And that can happen. I mean, it may sometimes feel like you're trying to do it and it's a bit artificial, but actually if you do, then it can just become natural over time. So that rather than your default position being just to sort of back up and protect yourself, you might actually find yourself being a bit more receptive, a bit more interested, a bit more friendly to people. Certainly I can't actually track how it's changed for me, but I do know that, you know, years ago I was completely paranoid. You know, I was really scared of people. I distrusted people, you know. I'd grown up with all sorts of conditions which led me to believe that, you know, basically people weren't very good and not very nice, and that actually it was being completely naive to think otherwise. And that would make me, I suppose, distrust people, and therefore it would really affect me actually connecting with people. I would withdraw with people, I'd avoid getting into talking with people. You know, if I was on the bus or the tube and someone would talk with me, I would just kind of, you know, try and avoid it and whatever. You know, and sometimes, you know, it might be somebody trying to chat you up and then you would want to, you know, stop them, but other times it wouldn't. And again, yeah, I do remember one time when I just had this assumption that that's what they're going to do, but actually they weren't. They just wanted to be friendly, and we were actually going to the same thing later on, and we're going to be working together, and we met in a park, and we were sitting on a bench, and I just assumed he was trying to chat me up, so I was really unfriendly to him, and was completely mortified when he later found that we were some of the colleagues. So, anyway. But so, yeah, so in a way, it's sort of like, that was my habit. It's not my habit now. I do feel a lot more interested in people, and I don't know quite how that happened, but I think a lot of it is through trying to practice ethics and practicing the Metta Bhavana. Because I think there's a lot of effects that you're not aware of, or you bear the fruits much, much later with this practice. So one thing I find quite interesting about the Metta Bhavana is that we're not actually trying to develop metta towards an actual person, but towards these mental representations we have of them, in a way. The Buddha, in some of his early suttas, he talks about internal and external mind objects. And I kind of like that phrase. So in a way, the versions of people in the world you've got inside, they're your internal mind objects, and the actual reality in the world is the external mind object. So I might have an internal mind object of Jnananda, say, and there he is as an external mind object, and we have that of all kinds of people in the world, yeah? So in the practice, we're working with that internal mind object, and then in the world, when we interact with people, we're working with the actual external mind object. And I think you need to be doing both. And they'd also, you know, if you're kind to somebody in the world, that will affect your internal mind object. And if you work with metta in your internal mind object, it may make you kinder in the world. So there is again that kind of mutually reinforcing loop there between the internal and external aspects of our practice. So it's just that twofold approach, really. And I think that also kind of links in with, I think most people on a spiritual path have a kind of conflict at times between their inner life, their outer life, a life of activity, a life of calm. And so meditating can be very... it can feel very much a way of us giving ourselves time to go within, to get to know ourselves, to access a bit more spaciousness, a bit more calm, different states of mind. And we're very much, working with creating calmer conditions maybe from our everyday bustle and being very, very busy. And given that how identified lots of us are with being very busy and how hard it can be to break that habit and give ourselves a bit of time, a bit of space, I think it's really important. You know, and going on retreat, again, is really important to try and keep a bit of balance and not just get totally caught up in being busy. The Tibetans talk about Western laziness, and that's about us being very, very busy all the time and not really allowing ourselves time to... to devote ourselves to things that are more meaningful and more important in life, of more value in life, that we just kind of get caught up with activity, with being busy and with our work and whatever else it is. So it's quite interesting seeing that you can be so busy and it can also be a form of laziness. If you go off on retreat, you may find the conditions very positive. You may get into very positive mental states. I certainly find that my meditation practice goes much deeper and often I do get into very, very positive mental states on retreats, not always, but quite often now. In the past I used to get into lots of difficulties, but now it seems like that's where I'm at. And it's nice, it's good, and I think it refreshes me, and I think being in those positive mental states then has a positive impact on how I am in the world when I come off on retreat. But I think we can't just go for that inner life. I suppose some people do if you're a hermit or something. If you're living in a monastery or a convent or something, in a way you've made that choice. But I suppose what I would say is that those conditions may support us in developing those positive mental states, and they may help us while we're there to be in a sort of calmer state. But it may not give us the opportunity to work with underlying issues and key aspects of our conditioning. So it's a bit like when you have a stimulus, you react to it, but when that stimulus isn't there, you don't react to it. So in the same way, if you choose to withdraw from the world and you don't have all the things that challenge you and press your buttons, then you may end up feeling very calm and very, you know, like you're very sorted. But then if you then go back into the world and have all those conditions again, you may find yourself reacting in the same old way with those old patterns, you know. However much you may have thought that you progressed spiritually, actually there's that whole area that you've never addressed. So I don't think it's necessarily the answer for everybody to withdraw. And I think what we need to think about is, well, how do we work with that stuff? And I think actually, I know it's taken me ages to get to being in the city, but that's where living in the city, having the urban life can work. You know, that life of activity in quite challenging and difficult situations gives us lots of opportunities for practice. Lots of for practice of metta, patience, all kinds of things, because it's not easy living in the city. There are lots of things in particular about living in a city. We've got lots and lots of people in a limited amount of space. Many, many people that we don't know. So it can feel a bit overwhelming. You can feel a bit alone. Something about being in a city can be quite impersonal. You know, it's not unusual that you can live somewhere for many years and not know or speak to your neighbours nowadays. You know, whereas if you're living in the countryside, that I think would be very unlikely. Even if you're on a retreat and you go and walk in the countryside, people will say hello to you. Whereas if you're walking down the street in London, people quite often will just walk past you and, you know, if you said hello to them, they might think that you were a bit crazy, you know. Certainly, you do notice, you know, somebody on a tube train starts talking, then lots of people are sort of looking at them, you know, might they be mentally disturbed, might they be this, that and the other. They don't think it's just somebody wanting to be friendly. I was really struck, actually, when they had the Olympics, you know, that there actually seemed a kind of very spontaneous sense of metta there, and a lot of people just being friendly and interacting and being helpful to complete strangers. And that was a time when I had a lot of conversations on the tubes and the buses, and, you know, it was just very interesting that there was that sort of sense of connection, humanity, shared, you know, and also wishing well for all the people who were competing, you know, whether or not they happened to be of one's nationality or whatever. It just seemed like there was that genuine, spontaneous feeling of metta that was there. And it would be really great if that could be our normal way of being. You know, having had that glimpse of it, well, why not? In a way. You know, let's work towards doing that in our own little ways. It's also true in the city that you're having to interact with a lot of people that you might not like and you might not choose to be around, but you just have to. And you're often in situations where you just have to be with a lot of people, even if you're feeling like you want to be alone or in a more peaceful place. You know, if you're working, if you're travelling in the city, particularly around rush hour, I mean, it's not a pleasant experience, is it? You know, you're just packed in around all these other people and everybody's wanting to get there and people are pushing and shoving each other. And it's very easy to then not think of people as people in a way, but think of them as, you know, they're a hindrance. You know, because they might stop you getting on the train you want to get onto, or they might be pushing you out of the way, or they might be walking really slowly and you need to get somewhere. You know. So all these are actually opportunities for practicing metta. You know, if you're in a traffic jam, say you're driving along and there's a traffic jam or there are lights and somebody in front hasn't noticed the lights have changed, you know, do you get really aggressive and start hooting? Or can you be patient, you know? If you're really frustrated with something and you're having to deal with somebody who works for an organisation that has just been giving you a really hard time, do you take it out on that person, or can you actually see them as an individual human being who probably doesn't really like that job, but anyway, it's not their fault? You know, can we get beyond our own self-interest, our own personal responses, to actually just connect on a human level? Just take them in as a human being. You don't actually have to know them, you don't have to like them, but you can actually, you know, treat them with respect, you know, have some consideration. Just see that they're a person, just like you. Yeah, I remember, Gianola, you brought up last year about that thing in the papers, the checkout person who got really upset and I think refused to serve somebody who was on the mobile phone. And you can just imagine that happened a lot and they just reached their point of feeling completely demoralised and not seen and not appreciated and, you know, treated like impersonal, treated a lot like a human being. You know, and I think that can be the experience of a lot of people. So actually, if you, even if you just look at somebody and take them in, even if you just take a moment to listen to them, or even just, you know, smile at them, you know, that can actually be really helpful to people. That can actually have an effect. And lots of little simple, you know, acts of consideration, whether it's getting up for somebody who needs a seat, if you see a young parent with a child in a pushchair and they're at a flight of stairs or an elevator, you know, do you take the time to help them get up and down the stairs or not? You know, it probably takes no time out of your life, but it can make a big difference to somebody. So I think we have a lot of opportunities for little acts of kindness, as well as maybe, you know, choosing to work in ways that we can help people in bigger ways. I mean, I think there are a lot of people who are very committed to trying to create better conditions for people, whether it's in terms of like housing, you know, social workers, teachers, politicians. You know, they may have this urge to try and create better conditions for people to live in. And you can make that kind of a vocational thing. I suppose for us here at the Buddhist Centre, that's another thing. We're trying to share the Dharma, thinking that that will be something that will give people tools to live their lives better. So there's a sort of sense of metta behind that as well. Yes, I was supposed to be doing this in relation to the Metta Bhavana practice and the neutral person and the difficult person, which I haven't done, so I should probably say a little bit about that. But yeah, I mean, obviously, for most of us, the majority of people that we live in the city with are people we don't know. There may be a few people that are our friends. There may be more people that, say, we put in the fourth stage because we find them annoying or irritating or difficult. But there'll be a lot of people that we don't even know enough. We might see them but not know. So they would fit into the neutral stage. And there are probably millions of people that we don't really know and never even see that I suppose we would include in that fifth stage of all living beings. So, yeah, I suppose I have gone a little bit into it, actually, because I think the third stage is, well, what's your default response to strangers, you know? How do you interact with them? Are you open? Are you receptive? Are you friendly? Or do you just push them away? You don't have to feel an emotional connection to them, but you can still, you know, act in line with intentions of being kind and being concerned for people's welfare and well-being, and treat them with respect, consideration, be friendly, receptive, and be kind when you can. Yeah, there was somebody who was, I think it was kind of an art practice that they were doing a random act of kindness every day for a year or something. I kind of read an interview with them and I thought, well, that's a really nice thing to do, you know, and not that hard to do. Some of the things she did were really little, but, you know, just having that intention, and she said it had a really big effect on her, you know, it really changed in a way how she approached life. So, yeah, I think let's try and do that as much as we can. You know, we don't even have to talk with people. There's so much that we can communicate on an unspoken level. You know, through a look, through a smile, through just sort of giving people a bit of space. Or even just taking them in, as I've said. We all want to be seen, we all want to be heard, don't we, on a certain level. Obviously friends can do that for us more, but even when you're meeting somebody that you don't know, you get a sense of whether or not they're taking you in, don't you? And it gives an effect to how you feel. So if you're sort of in a shop and someone starts chatting to you and you really feel that they're actually responding to you as a fellow human being, then that feels good, doesn't it? Whereas if they're just on their phone or, you know, not paying attention, it's a very different experience. Um, Yeah, the neutral stage is also quite interesting, isn't it? I don't think there are very many people that are neutral, or that we have neutral feelings towards. I think we just have sort of slight feelings, either a bit more of liking or disliking, aversion or attraction towards people, even if it's very subtle. Because according to our conditionings, it's just so easy for us to see someone and make all these judgments. Apparently we see someone and how they look, the clothes they wear, you know, what ethnicity they are, what age they are, what sex they are, you know, how they speak, you know, what we get a sense of their education, all this kind of stuff. We're already making judgments about them, what class they are, deciding whether they're our kind of person or not our kind of person, based on completely, you know, unlikely, you know, things. But we, you know, we do it. I mean, what's been interesting for me, actually, practicing within the Buddhist Sangha, is there's all these people that I would never have dreamt of, you know, exchanging any words with, and that I would have thought were the last people I want to be, you know, around, who've become my friends, you know. Mm. No. Because there is that shared, something shared about being a human being that I think we can connect with everybody. One of Sangha Rachita's quotes that I really like is about him talking about why he's a Buddhist, and he believes that it's possible for any human being to be friends with another human being. And certainly for me, having gone through lots of different kind of political movements around identity as a woman, as a gay woman, black, and you know, all these kinds of things, you know, it was a real relief just to sort of get beyond all those identifications and just want to connect with people as people, you know. Not to say that differences and all those things aren't important, but I do think that there is a level where we can connect with other living beings, and that's what we're trying to cultivate more with the practice of metta and the practice of ethics. So with the difficult person, well, we're working a lot with our own shadow side, I think. Because the things that we tend to find annoying or difficult, or things that we hate about other people, are often linked to our own experiences, our own conditioning, and also our own personalities. You know, we often find the things that we don't like about ourselves, or we find difficult about ourselves, we then really don't like in somebody else. Or, you know, they remind us of somebody that, you know, we didn't like or gave us a hard time. And so it can be quite a mirror, actually. Just seeing, well, you've got all these feelings towards somebody, and what are they about? You know, are they true? Are they real? Are they just thoughts? Are they just emotions, in a way? Not about denying that people may behave unethically and that they may harm you, and it's not about just accepting anything that happens and being a doormat. Self-metta is always important, but I think we can get very caught up in blaming people or judging people and holding on to those, and sometimes that's because it's as much to do with our view of ourselves and the view of our world and our ego that we want to hold on to those views, those judgments, those identifications, as anything else. So in this stage, I think it's really good to sort of begin to see through those, a bit more fluidity, you know. Even if somebody has behaved badly towards you, even if you can see that somebody, you know, objectively is quite unethical, that's not the whole of them, you know. And if you take on board the idea that everybody has the potential to become a Buddha, well, so do they, you know. Their good qualities, their spiritual qualities may not be being expressed at the moment, but they do have that potential if the conditions change. So you can, in a way, wish them well from that level. You know, you can have some empathy about the conditions that have led them to how they are, because normally if somebody's behaving in a way that's harmful to others, it's because they've experienced very difficult conditions themselves at some point. But you can also think, well, yes, they're more than just my experience of them, you know. I can see this person not just in terms of the things I don't like about them, the things that they've done to me, but I can also see that they're a whole person, strengths, weaknesses, and yeah, they're trying their best, just as I'm trying my best to get by in this world, which is difficult. So there's that aspect that you can have. So there are a lot of people in the city that you might not know, but you can still find yourself having reactions towards because they're inconsiderate towards you, or because they get in your way, or because, you know, they're a colleague you don't like, or something like that. So it's quite interesting that we can, in a way, build up our muscles with like minor occasions of people, you know, being irritating and annoying, you know, which is, you know, a good opportunity for practice, so that when we actually get to people who are majorly annoying or who are really harmful, then, you know, we've got into the habit of working with that, of not just responding or holding on to that. So, yeah, there's so much diversity and difference of the people in the city, and it really gives us an opportunity to work with our fixed views and our fixed identities and the things that threaten our ego because they're unfamiliar. So I think in that stage, you know, that's one of the things we can be doing. Okay, so I think I've been talking a long time, so I'm going to wind up now, but I might leave you with a poem. So each poem should leave you. I think I'll just give you Hafiz, very short one, but I think it sort of speaks to an ideal of what we'd be doing if we're trying to practice metta. The intention, if not the reality. And love says, I will take care of you to everything that is near. I'll say that again. And love says, I will take care of you to everything that is near. And of course, in a city, there are a lot of people that are near. Thank you.